This is People First Radio On Demand, podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads, available when you want to listen at chly.ca, iTunes, and at the People First Radio website.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
Centuries of racism and dispossession have denied Indigenous peoples around the world the opportunity to enjoy such basic human rights as the right of self-determination, the right to cultural identity, the right to life, and the right to health. While Canada is generally seen as a leader in the global promotion of human rights, there are still significant problems with current laws and policies with respect to the rights and well-being of Indigenous peoples. A recent report by Amnesty International identified several issues of concern, stating that Canada has not been adequately protecting the rights of Aboriginal people. We're joined on the phone by Craig Benjamin of Amnesty International Canada. Welcome to People First Radio, Craig.
Hi there.
Amnesty International's 2010 report on the state of the world's human rights says that the Canadian government continued to make baseless claims that the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples does not apply in Canada. In the March 3, 2010 speech from the throne, the federal government promised to take steps to endorse the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Craig, tell us more about the declaration and what is happening in Canada.
Sure. The Declaration, like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, is a universal human rights instrument adopted by the UN General Assembly. In this case, its purpose was to fill an important gap in international human rights protections. All of the evidence from around the world tells us that even where states recognize fundamental human rights, like the right to freedom from discrimination, for example, the right to culture, that these rights are routinely denied to Indigenous peoples on the basis of a long history of racism that is, deeply entrenched in societies around the world, on the basis of laws that are fundamentally discriminatory, and the barriers to Indigenous peoples having access to justice. The Declaration is meant to be a tool to help address these fundamental injustices. It provides guidance to states, to institutions like human rights tribunals, and even to ordinary citizens about how to play a part in respecting and upholding the rights of Indigenous peoples. And more than anything else, people call it a roadmap to reconciliation. It's about balancing the rights of Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples in a more equitable way than is the practice around the world. It took some 20 years of negotiation in the United Nations to bring this declaration forward, and it was finally adopted in September of 2007, and it was a real triumph for the international human rights movement, for what it said about the ability to work together to address some of this racism and discrimination. But one of the really shocking things about this was that Canada, which had played a really active role in the last couple of years in establishing a consensus around this declaration, Canada very abruptly reversed its position and not only voted against the declaration at the UN General Assembly, but really went on a global campaign against the declaration, encouraging other states to oppose it, and repeatedly denouncing the declaration in public and at every opportunity it could get. Now, as you said, in the speech from the throne this year, the government made a commitment to take steps toward endorsing the declaration, but quite sadly, they really haven't changed their tune. Even after that speech from the throne, the government of Canada was appearing before the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal, and in response to a submission by Amnesty International, which was urging the tribunal to make use of the UN Declaration and other international human rights standards in assessing the discrimination faced by Indigenous children in Canada, the government of Canada made two really telling statements. It said that even if Canadian laws are in contravention of international human rights standards and laws, they say, well, that doesn't matter, we're going to stick with our laws. And the other thing that they said is that the UN Declaration has no weight in Canada and should not even be considered by the tribunal. So here, when it comes, push comes to shove, we see, unfortunately, that at least to date, the government of Canada still very unreasonably opposes the declaration.
Now, Craig, on March the 18th, 2010, a large coalition of Canadian groups and organizations organizations, including the Assembly of First Nations and Amnesty International Canada, not only welcomed the federal government's speech from the throne announcement about taking steps, as you've mentioned as well, to endorse the declaration, but the coalition also encouraged the Canadian government to work with Indigenous peoples on a respectful process for the endorsement and implementation of the declaration. It seems from what you've said that not much has happened. What are the expectations? What do you think might happen in the near future on this?
It's really hard to tell. I mean, frankly, the government's opposition to the declaration has seemed so irrational at times that it's quite hard to predict. You know, we knew leading up to its adoption by the UN General Assembly that Canada's senior bureaucrats who had reviewed the declaration from the point of view of the legality, its legal implications in Canada, from the point of view of Canadian policies in various areas, had all recommended that the government endorse the declaration. So we never really understood why the government should take such an abrupt about-face in the first place. So it was really quite hard to understand their policies in this respect. And certainly there's very little openness or transparency. There have been almost no discussion between the government and Indigenous peoples around its position. There have been some meetings held, but they really haven't been anything like an open exchange. So it's quite hard to predict what they're going to do. I mean, I think on the positive side, the statement that they intend to move toward endorsing the declaration makes us hope that maybe, in fact, they will make a positive statement. And more importantly, that they will then start to live up to it. Because I think one thing that's really important to clarify, because the Canadian government has claimed the declaration has no weight in Canada, but in fact it does. It already has weight in Canada by the fact it was adopted by the UN General Assembly. An endorsement by Canada is purely symbolic. It's simply a statement that they intend to live up to it. And what we really want to see then, of course, is the action toward really doing that, to implement it. On the downside, I think one of the things that many people are afraid of is the possibility that rather than endorsing the declaration in a full and wholehearted way and committing itself to implement it, the government will use the opportunity to strike another blow at the declaration. There's real concern that instead of endorsing it in a full way, that they will instead say, well, there are some parts of it that are acceptable to us and some parts that aren't acceptable to us, and that they will then sort of draw lines and say, we'll work on these provisions and not on these other provisions. And that's the worst possible outcome, because the declaration is meant to work as a whole. And if you start looking at articles in isolation from each other, that's when you lose the balancing effect. That's when you lose the capacity of the declaration to really be an effective tool for reconciliation.
Amnesty International also mentions in its annual report that in September, a hearing opened before the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal into underfunding of First Nation Child and Family Services compared with other communities. Tell us more about that.
This is the case at which Canada said the declaration should not be used as one of the standards to guide the Human Rights Tribunal. This case was brought forward by an organization called the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society. That is an organization set up to work on behalf of all of those services and individual First Nations across the country that assist children and families. The case was brought forward because the way it works in Canada is that while provinces and territories generally have the jurisdiction for child services, uniquely for First Nations children on reserve, these services are funded by the federal government, and they're typically delivered by First Nations organizations. And what has happened is that the federal funding formula results in these organizations receiving dramatically less money per child than organizations serving children in predominantly non-Indigenous communities. And this is despite the fact that there is quite evidently greater need within Aboriginal communities, and there's often a much higher cost in delivering services because they may be remote. The result is that there is a dramatic curtailment, a dramatic limitation of the kinds of services available to children and families. And perhaps the worst of this is that the services that are most needed, the kind of early intervention services that provide assistance to parents to make sure that they're able to meet their children's needs, these kinds of early intervention services are often not available. And instead, all that's available is the kind of last resort measure, which is the measure to remove a child from a family. And to be clear about this, we're talking about cases not of children facing abuse, but of children facing what's called neglect, where the parents just, for various reasons, economic or social, just don't have adequate tools or resources to meet their children's needs. Early intervention programs are meant to help them, you know, meet those needs, but keep the child in their culture, in their community, in the family, and keep the family together. And this is the kind of service that's often missing in average in First Nations communities because the money isn't there for it. And one of the results is there's an extraordinary number of First Nations children being taken away from their families for these reasons. In fact, the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society estimates that there are many times more children being taken from First Nations families today than there were at the height of the residential school era. So the potential for really long-term harm to Aboriginal cultures and Aboriginal communities is profound in this. The case went to the Human Rights Tribunal because despite government studies into this issue that recommended increased funding, despite the best efforts of organizations like the Assembly of First Nations and others to draw attention to this issue, and despite the fact that United Nations human rights bodies have called attention to the issue, the federal government has really dug in its heels around providing adequate funding. So the case went to the Human Rights Tribunal in the hope that the Human Rights Tribunal could break the logjam, that it would make a ruling that this was discriminatory and therefore call upon the government to increase the funding. And the really sad thing is that the federal government, instead of responding and saying, you know, we know that we're underfunding and we want to correct the problem, instead they're fighting tooth and nail against the Human Rights Tribunal even hearing the case. They're actually trying to create a loophole in the Canadian Human Rights Act by making this argument that the Human Rights Act, which applies to services, doesn't apply to the government decisions about that determine the shape of those services, that the Human Rights Act does not apply to the funding decisions, to the funding formulas, which is the government's principal role, and therefore the government would be exempt from consideration. Right now, we're waiting to hear on the tribunal's decision on whether they'll accept that argument or not.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm Kevin. I'm here with Ashta today. In an open letter to the Canadian Prime Minister earlier this year, 39 Aboriginal and civil society organizations from across Canada called on the federal government to demonstrate its commitment to the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. This comes as Amnesty International reports Canada is not doing enough to protect the human rights of its Aboriginal peoples. The 2010 Amnesty International annual report highlights concerns about the treatment of Indigenous peoples in 16 countries around the world, including Canada. We're speaking with Craig Benjamin, who works with Amnesty International Canada in the area of human rights for Indigenous peoples.
Amnesty International's 2010 report also focuses on violence against Aboriginal women in Canada, stating that despite its stated commitment to stopping the violence, the Canadian government took no steps towards establishing such a plan. Craig, could you tell us more about that?
Sure. Now, this is an issue that really is quite amazing to see the failure of government to act, because concerns for the safety and welfare of Indigenous women have been expressed so strongly from all corners of Canadian society in recent years. Amnesty International published a report almost 6 years ago called Stolen Sisters that documented the very high rates of violence faced by Aboriginal women, violence in the family, but also violence in the community as a whole. Such that we see a homicide rate for Aboriginal women that's 3 to 5 times higher than that faced by non-Indigenous women. And this is an issue which it's Aboriginal women have been raising for literally decades. It's an issue which has been acknowledged by the federal government to such a level that they have spoken before the United Nations and said this is a human rights concern that they have to address. So there's really no doubt about the seriousness or the urgency. But what we don't see is action to back up that acknowledgement. What the Native Women's Association of Canada has called for, what the Assembly of First Nations has called for, what we have called for, and what the United Nations have called for, is a comprehensive response. I mean, there's no doubt that there are many good and valuable programs across the country, whether it's shelters for women or it's programs of counseling for men. There's good programs out there. But individual, isolated programs that face short-term funding, that alone is certainly not enough. And what everyone who's looked into the issue has said is we need a comprehensive approach that deals with the social and economic factors that put Aboriginal women at risk, that deals with the failure of police across this country to respond adequately when Aboriginal women go missing, that deals with the justice system and how it treats Aboriginal people. You know, all of these pieces have to be part of the solution. We need something that's comprehensive. We need something that's coordinated. We don't need more piecemeal approaches. What we've heard from the federal government so far is that they're willing to commit additional money. In this year's budget, they announced $10 million over 5 years. We don't know how that money is going to be spent. One could easily imagine that's $10 million being spent on more programs that would be needed, that would be valued, and would certainly be welcome. But it's not a commitment to the kind of comprehensive response that's needed. To take just one example of how far away we are in Canada from the necessary response, police forces in Canada still do not keep track of the Indigenous women's experience of violence, so that there are no nationally available statistics that show exactly what is happening. Police forces, at least 40% of the cases, fail to even record whether the victims of crime are Aboriginal or not. There's inadequate sharing of this kind of data. And we hear over and over again from families who have a missing daughter or sister or mother that when they go to police and seek their help, they're unable to determine if the police are doing everything they're supposed to because the police won't tell them what their policies are. There are no national missing persons policies, and the policies of individual police forces are often not transparent or in any way accountable to the public. Family members just simply don't know what they can expect of police. They don't know what the policies are. They don't know what the processes are. So this is really how far we are away from responding to the seriousness of this problem.
Now, Craig Benjamin, we just have a moment left. I'm wondering if there's anything else you'd like to add to this conversation today.
Well, the one thing we haven't touched on is the issue of land rights, and just to say this is, again, a critical part of the situation, that we see the failure of governments in Canada to reach fair and timely resolution of land disputes. And even while disputes are still underway, we see that the resources that could be used to help enrich Indigenous communities, whether it's access to the natural environment or the wealth that lies beneath the land, we see this being effectively sold out from underneath Aboriginal people to the detriment of their environment, to the detriment of their way of life, without adequate consideration or protection of Indigenous people's rights. And that's another critical dimension of the problems faced by Indigenous people in this country.
Thank you for taking the time to join us today. It was very much appreciated.
My pleasure.
Craig Benjamin is a campaigner for the human rights of Indigenous peoples. He works with Amnesty International Canada. You can find his blog online at Amnesty International Canada's website. Just go to amnesty.ca and find Indigenous peoples in the drop-down list of priority concerns.
This is a People First Radio podcast. People First Radio is an initiative of Columbian Center Society in partnership with Radio Malaspina Society and produced at CHLY Community Radio in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed in this interview do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the partnering organizations. Visit us online. Just Google People First Radio to find our webpage.